Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in this segment we're going to begin an examination of the circumstances surrounding the assassination of Martin Luther King on April 4th, 1968. In fact, it's more than an examination of the circumstances, it's an examination of the assassination itself. For the information in these segments, we're going to be relying on a fabulous new book about the assassination of Martin Luther King, in my opinion the best single book on this subject, and one of the very best books ever on American political assassinations. The title of the book is Orders to Kill. That's authored by William F. Pepper, P-E-P-P-E-R. It's subtitled The Truth Behind the Murder of Martin Luther King. It's published in hardcover by Carroll and Graff, C-A-R-R-O-L-L and Graff, G-R-A-F. Hardcover edition, copyright 1995. The author is currently one of the attorneys for James Earl Ray, Jr., or James Earl Ray, who has been fingered as the, quote, assassin, unquote. In fact, as most students of this particular event are aware, James Earl Ray is a patsy. On the book's flap, it describes Dr. William F. Pepper as follows. Dr. William F. Pepper is James Earl Ray's attorney. He is a barrister in England, a U.S. attorney, and an associate of the Chartered Institute of Arbitrators. He practices international human rights and constitutional law from London, has represented governments and heads of state, and appeared as an expert on international law issues. He has published two other books and various articles. And again, this book is a superb book, the best on Martin Luther King's assassination and one of the very best books about American assassinations. In fact, I think it illustrates the interface and operational cooperation between such seemingly disparate elements as organized crime, the intelligence community, and the military proper. And we're going to be examining all of those to one extent or another during the course of this series. James Earl Ray has been fingered as the official, quote, assassin, unquote, of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. In fact, he was a patsy in Radio Free America program number 8, available from archives on audio, about which I'll have more to say later. We discuss part of how James Earl Ray was set up as the patsy for the assassination of Martin Luther King, and discuss the fact that James Earl Ray could not have done what he is alleged to have done. What we're going to do in this first segment is to examine the author's delineation of a portion of the vast conspiracy to kill Martin Luther King, Jr. This portion of the conspiracy involves coordination between the intelligence community, law enforcement, and organized crime. We are, for the purposes of investigative shorthand, going to refer to this as the civilian conspiracy. As we will see in subsequent segments, there was also a military conspiracy, part of the same overall strategic planning, but for the purposes of journalistic shorthand, I'm going to refer to them as the civilian or organized crime conspiracy and the military or governmental conspiracy. In fact, as I said, both are part of the same event. What happened with regard to the assassination of Martin Luther King was that he was slain by a group of organized crime figures operating in conjunction with the intelligence community, the national security establishment, and elements of law enforcement. The actual shooting appears to have been done by an operative named Raoul. His last name is protected by this author because this case is currently under litigation. Raoul, whom he calls Pereira, was in fact the very same Raoul whom James Earl Ray fingered as the individual who was trafficking him around, giving him money, engaging him in criminal enterprises, and in fact helping to set him up as the patsy. According to the information developed by Dr. William Pepper, the organized crime conspiracy involved an effort on the part of the Carlos Marcello Southwest American Mafia Organization, and its key Memphis operative was a Memphis produce dealer and organized crime figure named Frank C. Liberto, L-I-B-E-R-T-O, who recruited Raul and also a gambling associate named Lloyd Jowers. Lloyd Jowers is an individual whose name crops up in the context of the assassination. He ran a restaurant called Jim's Grill, and according to Dr. William Pepper, Lloyd Jowers was hired to take care of the murder weapon and to dispose of it after Raoul shot and killed Dr. Martin Luther King from his cover in some bushes in back of Jim's Grill. What we're going to examine first is a delineation of some aspects of the conspiracy, or rather, one of the very first people to discover this aspect of the conspiracy, and by this aspect I mean the organized crime aspect of it, again, involving the Southwest American Organized Crime Organization of Carlos Marcello, the mafia godfather of New Orleans, and a very influential organized crime figure throughout the American South and Southwest. One of the names, by the way, mentioned in connection with the assassination of John Kennedy by the House Select Committee on Assassinations. The discussion here is of the information overheard by a fellow named John McFerrin, who was one of the very first individuals to hear about, or actually to come across, the role of a Memphis produce dealer and organized crime figure Frank Liberto in this particular scheme. Again, Liberto was operating this contract on behalf of Carlos Marcello and the New Orleans Organized Crime Organization, in turn acting in conjunction, as we will see in later segments, with the most powerful individuals and elements in the American power establishment. William F. Pepper writes of McFerrin, Liberto and Company. Finally, I got McFerrin's story after another face-to-face meeting was arranged. McFerrin, by the way, that's M small c capital F-E-R-R-E-N, maintained that on the afternoon of April 4th, 1968, while he was shopping at the Liberto and Latch, or LL&L Produce Company in Memphis, he saw the company's president, Frank Liberto, L-I-B-E-R-T-O, talking on the telephone, having been handed the phone by one of the bosses who had answered it. As McFerrin went to the back of the store, where there was an office on the other side of the wall, he heard Liberto's conversation through the open door. He insisted that he heard Liberto say, quote, "I told you not to call me here. Shoot the son of a bitch when he comes on the balcony," unquote. Liberto told the caller that he should collect his money from Liberto's brother in New Orleans after he had finished. The sum of $5,000 was mentioned. McFerrin had heard rumors that Frank Liberto had some underworld connections. This was none of McFerrin's business, he thought, and so he just put the conversation out of his mind. He was jolted, however, when just an hour later, after he arrived back in Somerville, he heard of Martin Luther King's assassination. That, by the way, is Somerville, Tennessee. By the way, I also want to make it clear that I'm not even going to attempt to delineate all of the connections in the civilian side of the conspiracy. Suffice it to say that there are significant points of interface between people like Raoul, who also was involved with gun running, and some of the organized crime provinces of people like Carlos Marcello and his organization. In fact, Raoul appears to have been involved in a gun running operation that overlapped Marcello's operations to a considerable extent. More on the information developed by John McFerrin. After agonizing for 2 days, McFerrin called Baxton Bryant, B-R-Y-A-N-T, the executive director of the Tennessee Council on Human Rights, at his home in Nashville. Bryant, a Methodist minister, had been involved behind the scenes in trying to mediate the garbage strike. McFerrin asked Bryant to come to Somerville. When Bryant got to Somerville and heard McFerrin's story, Bryant insisted that he tell it to the FBI. McFerrin was reluctant until Bryant promised him that either his name would be kept secret or he and his family would receive protection. That night, Bryant drove to Memphis, where he telephoned Frank Holloman at home and insisted on seeing him immediately. Around midnight, they met in Holloman's office at police headquarters. Soon after, Homicide Chief N.E. Zachary and FBI Agent O.B. Johnson arrived. The three listened to Bryant's story and asked to see McFerrin at once. Bryant, knowing that McFerrin wouldn't talk on the telephone, drove back the 40 miles to Somerville and managed to convince his friend to get out of bed and go to Memphis. On Monday, April 8th at 3 o'clock a.m., Zachary and Johnson began interrogating McFerrin in Bryant's room at the Peabody. Also present was David Kaywood, C-A-Y-W-O-O-D, an ACLU attorney. They finished around 5 o'clock a.m., and Zachary and Johnson taped McFerrin's account and had him sketch the office in which he had seen Liberto and another one of the bosses down to its furnishings, the position of the men, and where he himself had stood in the corridor listening. They promised to check it out thoroughly. 3 days later, Bryant was told that the FBI believed that if McFerrin overheard the telephone call at all, it wasn't related to the assassination. McFerrin told me that as a result of the way he was treated, he was most uncomfortable. He felt he was looked on as a criminal himself. The House Select Committee on Assassinations had uncovered another independent reference to the possible involvement of a Frank Liberto, the story told by Morris Davis summarized below. Noted The House Select Committee on Assassinations had uncovered another independent reference to the possible involvement of a Frank Liberto. The story told by Morris Davis, summarized below, noted Liberto's well-known racial bias and even ascertained that his brother, Salvatore, who lived in Louisiana, was indirectly connected to organized crime leader Carlos Marcello, a fact that was unknown to McFerrin. Nevertheless, the House Select Committee on Assassinations elected to dismiss McFerrin's story, just as the MPD and the FBI had. Shortly after the assassination, Time magazine stringer William Sartor, S-A-R-T-O-R, had investigated McFerrin's story. He concluded that organized crime was responsible for the killing, having connected to his own satisfaction Memphis produce dealer Frank C. Liberto with Carlos Marcello, the New Orleans mafia leader. The House Select Committee on Assassinations concluded, after what it termed an extensive investigation, that no evidence existed to tie either Liberto or Marcello to the assassination. As we will see later on, the House Select Committee on Assassinations investigation was badly, badly compromised. More about that later. Also, bear in mind, too, that the organized crime connections were only some of the many, many connections to this event, as we shall see. Later on, in Orders to Kill, there is an account of Lloyd Jowers, again, the manager of Jim's Grill, or the proprietor of Jim's Grill, a gambling associate of Frank C. Liberto, and an individual who was recruited to store the weapon used by Raoul to kill Martin Luther King, both before and after the assassination. Jowers was deposed with his attorney Lewis Garrison present, G-A-R-R-I-S-O-N, and the account of Lloyd Jowers' role in the assassination of Martin Luther King, as related by Lloyd Jowers in the presence of his attorney, is set forth in Orders to Kill as follows. Jowers agreed to answer some questions about the killing through his lawyer. There would be no recordings of his statement, and the attorney Lewis Garrison would take the follow-up question to him for his response. On March 14, 1995, the process began in Garrison's 400 North Main Street office. While he provided some new details of the conspiracy, much of what he said confirmed information obtained previously from Betty Spates, Betty's sister Bobby Smith, and taxi driver James McCraw. At the outset, Garrison stressed that the whole story did not originate with Jowers. He was uncertain whose brainstorm it was, but believed that it originated with Willie Akins and Ken Herman, that's A-K-I-N-S. Though he emphasized that it was not concocted by Jowers, he had to acknowledge that his client did go along with it for a while. Jowers contended that in March of 1968, he was first approached by a local businessman who dealt in securities and bonds, and whom he had come to know from his gambling activity with Frank Liberto. This man told him that because of the location of Jim's Grill, he was going to be asked to provide certain assistance in the carrying out of a contract to assassinate Martin Luther King. In exchange for this assistance, he would be paid handsomely. On March 15th, soon after this conversation, Jowers was approached by produce man Frank C. Liberto, to whom he owed a very large gambling debt. This debt would be forgiven, Liberto told him, and he would receive a large amount of money if he would provide the assistance initially mentioned by the messenger. Specifically, Liberto said, one, $100,000 would be delivered to him in cash on the bottom of an M.E. Carter vegetable produce box. The money came from New Orleans, as did the contract on King's life. By the way, interrupting, M.E. Carter was a produce distribution company very closely affiliated with LL&L of Frank C. Liberto. Continuing, two, he, Jowers, would be visited by a man who would bring the murder weapon, a rifle, and leave it with him for pickup at the right time. Three, there would be a patsy or decoy to distract attention. Four, the police, some of whom were involved, would be nowhere in sight. Again, the patsy was James Earl Ray, and some of the circumstances surrounding his being set up are set forth in the aforementioned Radio Free America number 8. I'm not going to linger on that aspect of the assassination. Suffice it to say that James Earl Ray did not kill Martin Luther King. He was being set up for this crime by Raoul and some of his associates. Continuing. Jowers agreed. As Liberto said, a man did come to see him. In fact, he met with this man on two occasions before April 4th. Jowers thought that he introduced himself as Raoul or Royal. Jowers said he appeared to have a Latin/Indian appearance. He was about 5'9" in height and weighed approximately 145 to 155 pounds. He had dark hair and appeared to be between 35 and 40 years old. This description matched that provided by Cheryl and James. They discussed the plans for the killing. Raul told Jowers that his role would be to receive and hold the murder weapon on the day of the killing until Raul picked it up. After the shooting, Jowers would have to take charge of it again and keep it concealed until Raul came to take it away. Jowers was also expected to keep his staff out of the way at all times. He confirmed Bobby's story that he instructed her not to follow her usual practice of taking food to Grace Walton. That was one of his waitresses, by the way. Continuing. On the morning of April 4th, sometime around 11 a.m., after the rush was over, Raul, according to plan, came into Jim's Grill, bringing with him a rifle concealed in a box which he turned over to Jowers to hold. Jowers said that Raul told him that he would be back later that afternoon to pick it up. Jowers put the gun under the counter and carried on with his work. He next admitted that he took his nap in the back room sometime around or after 1 p.m. when the lunch crowd had gone. He woke and began to work again around 4 p.m. Sometime later, Raul returned briefly and took the gun from him and went back into the kitchen area with it. Jowers claimed to be uncertain as to whether he remained in the rear of the grill or went upstairs by the back stairway. According to James's recollections, Raul was upstairs off and on during the afternoon. It therefore seems more likely that Raul took the gun upstairs to room 5B and concealed it there. Jowers said that sometime before 6 p.m., he went out into the brush where he joined another person. He did not provide any more details except to admit that immediately after the shot, he picked up the rifle which had been placed on the ground and carried it on the run in through the back door of Jim's Grill. As he ran into the back of the grill, he was confronted by Betty, that's Betty Spates, one of his waitresses and also a lover of his, who, as she had said, stood near him as he broke the gun down, wrapped it in a cloth, and quickly put it under the counter in the grill itself. Jowers finally confirmed that her recollection of the events was basically correct. He also admitted that the next morning between 10 and 11 a.m., he showed the rifle, which was in a box under the counter, to taxi driver James McCraw, thus confirming McCraw's recollection. Sometime later that morning, but before noon, Raul reappeared in the grill, picked up the gun, and took it away. He said he never saw the rifle again and had no idea where it was taken or where it is today. When McCraw was deposed in mid-June of 1995, Jowers, in front of Chastain and Garrison, explicitly threatened McCraw just prior to the deposition beginning. He said to McCraw, who was rising to greet him, something like, quote, "You'd better stand up while you can, because if you continue to run your mouth, you won't be able to stand up again," unquote. We should note that the threat made by Jowers there was in the context, or should be seen in the context of the high degree of mortality that has affected people who have had first-hand information about what really happened in some of our political assassinations and attempted to bring that out to the public. By the way, we've also seen just how compromised the House Select Committee on Assassinations investigation was to give people an idea, to give listeners an idea of just how serious that death threat should have been taken and just how far off the beam the House Select Committee on Assassinations investigation was. We're going to next examine a brief incident where attorney Mark Lane, a well-known assassination researcher, not an individual I think a whole lot of, but an individual who at the time was James Earl Ray's attorney, Lane confronted G. Robert Blakey, the chief counsel for the House Select Committee on Assassinations, concerning allegations of law enforcement and intelligence community involvement in the assassination of Martin Luther King. The author writes here, "After the meeting, an argument erupted between Blakey and Lane. I stepped between them as Blakey was telling Lane that if he kept it up, there was no question that he'd be taken care of once and for all. I was shocked." Indeed, according to William Pepper, anyway, G. Robert Blakey actually threatened Mark Lane with what would appear to be violence or even death. And we should understand that not only was that threat something to be taken seriously, but that G. Robert Blakey and his efforts are not to be taken seriously. To give you an idea of just how, shall we say, creative G. Robert Blakey's political investigative instincts were, we turn once again to Orders to Kill, and William Pepper writes, "As my investigation proceeded during these early days," these are the mid-70s when G. Robert Blakey had been installed as chief counsel for House Select Committee after a fellow named Richard Sprague was removed, "As my investigation proceeded during these early days, I reviewed a copy of a most unusual affidavit executed by Blakey on February 4th, 1976. It was prepared and submitted to the court in a civil action brought by Cleveland, Las Vegas crime syndicate leader Morris Dalitz against Penthouse Magazine as a result of an article that alleged the involvement of organized crime in the development of Rancho La Costa, California resort. The allegation of criminal involvement was tied to Dalitz's involvement with the project. Blakey, as an expert witness, contended that Mo Dalitz had no connection with organized crime. This was extraordinary because it was by then a well-established fact that Dalitz was a long-time major syndicate operator. Subsequently, on September 10, 1979, the Wall Street Journal noted that Dalitz had long been identified by federal authorities as an ongoing senior advisor to organized crime. Because the murder of Dr. King could well have involved elements of organized crime, I was concerned that the counsel steering the investigation would take such a position only a short time before he took control over the HSCA. Blakey's expert opinion was ultimately not accepted, and Penthouse's defense of the piece was successful. I was also very uneasy with the new chief counsel's apparently cozy relationship with the CIA and FBI, which moved him to give the intelligence agencies influence over his staff's request for files, documents, and records. Other factors were unsettling as well. The early removal of 28 staffers, the insistence on secrecy, even the requirement that all staff sign non-disclosure agreements with harsh penalties for violation, the instruction to staff members that they were to have no contact with critics without Blakey's personal authorization, and the absence of accountability of committee consultants to anyone beyond the immediate committee leadership. I was thus led to conclude early on that the reconstituted committee leadership had no intention of conducting an independent investigation. One person who did attempt an independent investigation was an individual I alluded to earlier, a fellow named William Sartor, S-A-R-T-O-R, a writer for Time magazine, who began investigating the Liberto Lloyd Jowers Marcello civilian contract, as I've termed it. Of the fate of William Sartor and his investigation, the author William Pepper writes as follows. Around this time, I became immersed in the mysteries surrounding the work and death of William Sartor. As mentioned earlier, Sartor became deeply involved with the case after following up on John McFerrin's story. Until his death, he increasingly believed organized crime was involved in the murder, in particular the Carlos Marcello organization in New Orleans. He spent considerable time in New Orleans meeting with Marcello contacts, including the man's nephew, Little Joe. In 1971, suddenly and unexpectedly, Bill Sartor died, ostensibly from an overdose, though he wasn't a drug user. Dale Doherty, who had been a boyhood friend of Sartor and Bill Sartor's mother, had long considered the death suspicious. The night before he died, he told Doherty that someone had agreed to talk to him in Memphis and that he was looking forward to the meeting. In recent days, he had been acting fearfully, often sitting in his mother's home watching the road with a shotgun at the ready. But that last evening, when he stopped off where she worked, he was in good spirits. He told her that he was going to stop at the Hickory Stick Bar for a couple of drinks and then go to bed. He asked her to wake him early. She couldn't rouse him the next morning. He was rushed to the hospital, but never regained consciousness. She had never been able to obtain a post-mortem report. The death certificate stated the cause was undetermined. Try as she might, no one would cooperate. Even her family physician, after making a few phone calls, told her to leave it alone. There it rested until I spoke with Doherty, who had become the trustee of Bill Sartor's notes and manuscript, a copy of which had been provided to the House Select Committee on Assassinations. I began to explore what appeared to be the more relevant of Sartor's leads. He noted that produce man Frank Liberto flew to Detroit the night that James Earl Ray was extradited from London. He learned this following a telephone conversation between Sartor's girlfriend and future wife, who placed the call, and Liberto's partner, James Latch, who told her that since Ray was being brought back that night, Frank would be nowhere around. I found this interesting because it showed apprehension on Liberto's part and also revealed that he had some family or contacts in Detroit, a city near the Canadian border. I also agreed to help Doherty and Mrs. Sartor get some answers about Sartor's death. Doherty, in turn, agreed to come to Memphis and attempt to interview one Pat Lyons, a former friend of Sartor's wife who had assisted them in their work on the case. Pat Lyons was one of the last persons to speak with Bill Sartor, who had called him from Waco the evening before his death about his visit to Memphis. When Doherty went to Memphis in November, Lyons flat out refused to speak with him. Later, one of our local investigators surveilled the house at which Lyons lived with his mother, which appeared to be permanently sealed with all the windows closed and the blinds drawn. This man was frightened. Sartre had written that at one point in 1969-70, a local hood held a knife to Lyon's throat and told him that he was under instructions to kill him. The order, according to Sartre, resulted from Lyon's help in his King investigation. Lyons told Sartor that the order came from an associate of Frank C. Liberto, and he was only able to get out of the immediate danger by pleading with his assailant to put him on the phone with Liberto's associate, or even Frank Liberto himself, and then convincing him that he was not helping Sartor but just trying to find out what he knew so that he could relay the information. By 1992, Liberto had been dead for 14 years, yet Lyons was still terrified. Meanwhile, Doherty worked at full speed in his efforts to get an autopsy report on Sartor. He enlisted the assistance of the Waco District Attorney Ken Abels, A-B-E-L-S, and one of his investigators, J.C. Rapp. And the substance of that investigation is related by William Pepper as follows. By the way, the reference to Detroit in Canada alludes to some of Raoul and James Earl Ray's gun-running activities which took place in Canada and across the northern border with the U.S. Of the autopsy report on William Sartor, the author writes as follows. On December 5th, Dale Doherty called me from Waco very excited. The hospital post-mortem on the report on the death of his friend, Bill Sartor, had finally been pried loose after 21 years. It showed that Sartor had a lethal dose of methaqualone in his system when he died. Since Sartor had no history of any such drug use, Doherty believed that it had been administered to him, either in the drinks he had had at the Hickory Stick Bar before he arrived home, or forcibly later that evening as he lay in bed. Ken Abels, the Waco district attorney, officially declared the death a homicide. He assigned his chief investigator, J.C. Rapp, to work with Doherty and coordinate the inquiry. Since much of Sartor's work prior to and at the time of his death involved the killing of Dr. King and focused on Shelby County, Doherty asked J.C. Rapp if he would formally request help from the Shelby County Attorney General's investigative staff. This he did, requesting help from Shelby County Attorney General's investigator Jim Smith, who had been designated as that office's liaison to our work on the King case. Smith went to his chief, who in turn secured the Attorney General's permission for his cooperation. I saw the investigation of Bill Sartor's death as being complementary to my inquiry into Dr. King's murder. The Waco investigation would be assisted by the knowledge I had about the King case, and I would have access to witnesses not previously available. We went to see Robert Patrick Lyons, who Sartor had maintained was attacked by a Liberto hitman who held a knife to his throat and said he was ordered to kill him for helping Sartor learn things he had no business knowing. Lyons had earlier rebuffed Kenny and Dale Doherty. Jim Smith and I, as a special counsel to the Sartor family, now would have several meetings with him. It was obvious that Lyons was still deathly afraid. He denied knowing any of the persons or the events concerning him described by Sartor. In a session a few months later, he told Jim Smith that he remembered Sartor calling him just before he died, saying he was coming to Memphis. Lyons thought Sartor mentioned the name of a person in the Waco area called Sam Termine, T-E-R-M-I-N-E, with whom he was going to meet. When Doherty mentioned this name to J.C. Rapp, it rang a bell. Termine was a club owner and one of Carlos Marcello's operatives in Waco. It was clear that Lyons knew far more than he was willing to admit. Again, those are some of the bare details concerning what I have termed the civilian conspiracy. This was the civilian aspect of a vast political conspiracy to kill Martin Luther King, and as we have seen in the past, that conspiracy also tied certainly to the assassinations of both Kennedy brothers and in all probability to the shooting of George Wallace as well. And the death of William Sartor illustrative of the obstacles that lie in the path of any would-be investigator. I've made reference to the archive shows. Those are available from a tape duplication service. That's called Archives on Audio. Their phone number is 415-346-1840. That concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening, and good night.